So we are in something brand new, right? 2018. We're in something else brand new. We are in the book of Colossians. Now, a long time ago, we went through Galatians. That was right when I got here. Then we spent some time going through the Gospel of John to look at who Jesus was. Since we finished the Gospel of John, which took us a long time, I realize, we have been in a lot of different places. We've looked at some Old Testament stories, the story of Jonah, the story of Joseph. We've looked at who we are in Christ. We've looked at who God is himself. And now we circle back again to sort of where we started, one of the epistles. One of the letters written to the New Testament church so as to build them up. And we'll continue going forward here. I'm not exactly sure how long Colossians will take us. We're neither going to belabor the fact nor rush through. Our goal is to see Jesus firmly planted in the middle of this church. Well, this church and this church. As we move through this book. So Paul wrote this book to the Colossians. And I was reminded of driving to Minnesota one time in search of donuts. Okay, I wasn't actually in search of donuts, but I had to go somewhere where I knew there was a great bakery. Now, God has since then decided Brock can't eat donuts. So Brock doesn't eat donuts anymore. One of the few things that I really struggle with. Flaky, yummy pastries. So if anybody ever finds a way to make gluten-free, flaky, yummy pastries, I will pay you a lot of money to give them to me. Anyway, moving beyond that, I get up to Minnesota, up to St. James, and I go to the bakery. My favorite bakery ever. And I go to buy donuts. And I picked out, since I like to call it extreme. Allison calls it gluttonous, but we're going to go with extreme. I bought 4 donuts, of which I was going to eat them all before I got home. I go to pay with this nice old lady that I've actually known since I was like this tall. I was in the town my dad was a dentist in. I go to pay, and I notice a sign that says, cash or check only. One time I had cash on me, but that was just once. I don't carry cash. I kind of know how to write a check if I have to. But most of the time I don't know where my checkbook is because Allison uses it because I don't. So I was stuck. All I had was a debit card. And I said, is there an ATM anywhere around? She said, well, there's one across the street. So now it was going to cost me $3 plus the donuts to buy my 4 donuts. And she said, Brock, just take the donuts. Okay, that was extremely kind of her. Like I said, I've known her for a long time. It's where my dad was a dentist, so he actually had, it was great. Maybe this is why I have a gluten issue. He had a charge account at the bakery. So I went to the bakery every time I was in town. I got donuts. I just charged it to my dad. It was great. I think they only cost 40 cents each. Doesn't matter. He was willing to pay. I was willing to eat. It was a great setup. So she said, Brock, just have the donuts. Say hi to your parents for me. And I said, thank you. But she did not accept the only type of payment I could give. I didn't have any other way to pay. I thought about rummaging through my car to try to find change, which there may have been some. But the only thing I had to give was unacceptable to her. That's the central theme out of the book of Colossians. The only form of payment you have is unacceptable to God. He doesn't take it. So in the book of Colossians, we see that Christ alone is sufficient. Christ alone is sufficient, wholly sufficient. Not partially sufficient. If you're partially sufficient, you're not actually sufficient. You have to be wholly sufficient, or it's none at all. That's the central theme. Christ is sufficient, and only Christ is sufficient. To understand how the book gets there, We've got to take a few moments to understand the letter itself. If you received a letter from someone who calls himself, I don't know, Prince Juju, you have an immediate assumption that it's a fake letter sent to you to try to get you to send money somewhere, right? But if you receive a letter or an email from a friend, everything you know about the friend, where they live, their family, and what's gone on in your interaction with them gets implanted in your brain before you start reading the letter. So if we jump into this letter without understanding the person who wrote it, when he wrote it, what was going on, why he wrote it, we'll never understand the letter the way it was intended to be, because Colossians is not some book with chapters that are all segregated from one another so that we can sort of take it piecemeal. It's a letter written for a purpose. And we've broken the letter down into multiple pieces so that we can find things in it. And he does change ideas like any letter would. But it is a letter with a purpose written by a person to a group. So we've got to understand it, or we got to understand the background, or we won't ever be able to rightly understand the book itself. So the background of Colossians. There's multiple different things we're going to look at, but first, we need to know the basics. We need to know the author, the date, the location, and the characters. So starting with the author, before we move anywhere else, this was written by Paul, okay? The Paul, as evidenced by how he starts the book. I, Paul, write to you, Colossians. So who's Paul? We know some things about Paul. Paul was a murderer. Let that sink in for a moment. He was a murderer. Paul was a persecutor of the church of God. And then finally, Paul became, amongst other things, an apostle. So Paul was an apostle after he was a murderer, after he was a persecutor of Christ's church, trying to destroy it. Then became an apostle of Jesus as he began to understand the truth. But we've got to reckon with the fact that he was a persecutor and a murderer before we can ever really move forward rightly. So if he becomes the Apostle Paul after being a murderer and a persecutor, what are the odds that we've been worse? What are they? Okay, if he becomes the Apostle Paul, what are the odds that we become better? They're both very, very low in terms of how we would gauge things. So A, we need to understand as we see grace spoken about here that Paul received more grace than you or I ever will. Also, Paul became further forward than we'll ever get. So he calls us to that level of beyond, realizing that he started further back. That's the author. That's this Paul. As we understand grace, as we understand Christ's sufficiency to take that Paul and make him into that one, he can certainly take me from here and bring me to here. As we realize it is only Jesus who does that, who brings us there. When you get a letter beyond just knowing who it was, if you get an email, the very first thing I ever look at on an email, I don't know why, it's just what I do, is the timestamp. I'm curious when you sent it. And I laugh sometimes because my timestamps to people frequently say 2 a.m., a lot of my emails happen to go out then. I don't know why. That's when my brain finishes an email, I guess. But I like it when I see somebody else's timestamp that says 2 a.m. That makes me feel like I'm not the only one. I also like to see timestamps just whenever they are. Why? Because I'm me and I like interesting, odd, irrelevant things. When was this written? The date. The date that Paul wrote this. Roughly 60 AD. Which sounds so incredibly unimportant. So incredibly irrelevant. We're talking, you know, 1950 years ago? Versus if it was 69 AD, then you're talking roughly 1940 or 30 years ago. So what does it matter? Why would we care when it was written? How does that affect anything? It was so long ago, it's all basically the same time. Now, imagine we're not talking 60 AD or 1950, 1960 years ago. Let's just imagine we're talking September 2000. Okay? Versus September 2002. Is there a functional difference in America between September of the year 2000 and September of the year 2002? Yes. I remember going through an airport the first time after 9/11, and all of a sudden, it was different. I actually left the security area with my bag and ID sitting with a friend inside the security area. This was not good. I was looking for food. That's all I wanted. And I got outside the security area with no ID. Nobody liked that at all. Thankfully, my friend had a phone, and so did I, so they were able to bring it to me, sort of like reach across the security thing, hand me my ID so I could get back into the airport. But there's a huge difference if you're talking about how you would function in an airport before 9/11 and how you would function in an airport after 9/11, and we're talking, in some cases, 3 months. But the date matters, particularly here how it matters. So it matters for a certain guy, a guy by the name of Nero Claudius Augustus Germanicus. Now, wouldn't you love to learn how to spell that as a kindergartner? What's your name? My name is Nero Claudius Augustus Germanicus. You know him better as just simply Nero. Now, why is Nero important? Why does it change anything if we're talking Nero time or before Nero time or after Nero time? Why does it matter? Mainly because Nero was sadistic, awful, evil. And when Paul talks about the grace that we receive, it's in the midst of the worst leader in the history of possibly the world. Now, like the President of the United States, dislike the President of the United States, what are the odds that he's as bad as the guy who cut Paul's head off, and then the story goes, dipped him in oil, lit him on fire, and put him on a post to be used as a street lamp? What are the odds that we are in a worse place than that? So when we see this letter written by Paul in this time of this great persecutor, we cannot say somehow we fit outside the paradigm of what Paul had going on, other than to say that we have different circumstances. He didn't have internet, right? He didn't have cars. He didn't have airplanes. He didn't have some of those things. But he had Nero as the emperor. Now, Paul was probably hiding somewhere far away from Nero. At least that's the way our brain goes. But Paul was in Rome. Do you know why he was in Rome? Because he was in jail. Under the rule of who? Nero. For the ultimate end of having his head cut off and to be martyred for the Christian faith. So don't fool yourself into thinking that maybe with this terrible leader at this terrible time, Paul was hiding off somewhere and safe. He was not. Not at all. He was knowingly and intentionally on his march toward death. In fact, he intentionally went to Jerusalem, knowing that this was probably going to be the end of him, and he was right. It took some time, it took some years, but his going to Jerusalem prompted all of these events that brought him to Rome. He's not somehow hiding and safe. He talks about the sufficiency of Christ in the midst of a terrible ruler, but in the midst of a terrible ruler who has him in custody. Paul is in custody there in Rome for the remainder of his days. Beyond just Paul, the location is Colossae. That's not a word that we typically say, though it makes sense. It's the book of Colossians, written to the people who lived in the city of Colossae. Colossae was an incredibly important town, thriving until about 100 years before this letter was written. After that, when Rome changed their structure, Colossae became less and less important, to the point at which it's considered the least important city any book of the Bible was written to. It was, for all intents and purposes, an unimportant market town, which is pretty much right where we live, isn't it? I don't mean that as an insult to Algona, but we're ultimately a pretty unimportant market town. That's okay. Apparently, unimportant market towns were important enough to get a letter from Paul that stood the test of time, that 2,000 years later was canonized and in our scriptures. Because the people in that unimportant market town were important enough to get his attention. If we were then, that's where we'd live. We'd likely have these same issues. Likely have these same problems. Likely get this same letter written from Paul to us. There's two particular characters as we go through this. One being Paul. We've already talked about him. You know who he is. The murderer. The persecutor. The apostle. The second is a guy named Epaphras. Now, Epaphras is the founder of the Colossian church. Paul didn't found it. He didn't plant this one. In fact, he likely had never been there personally. Why was he never there? Because Colossae was an unimportant market town. He didn't have any real reason to go the 15, 20 miles out of his way to hit a town that was small. A town that was going to take him more time than he was willing to give in that moment because he had other places he needed to get to. If you go to the book of Acts, we'll see that this wasn't something where he said, I don't care about those people. Rather, it was how God had orchestrated the strategy of his message going out. So Acts chapter 19, verse 10. Now this continued Paul's work in Ephesus, which is right near Colossae, maybe 20 or 30 miles away. Now this continued for 2 years, so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jews and Greeks. God put Paul in a particular place so that from that particular place his message would spread to everyone, including Colossae. So his message went out from Ephesus to Epaphras to the Colossians who started the Colossian church. Paul's message directly influencing that. Now he wasn't there personally, but God made sure it happened. And even not being there personally, Paul was willing to write a letter to these people in a small town that we sometimes feel like don't matter as much. So there you have it. The author, the date, the location, the characters that make this letter happen. Without them, we cannot understand this with the depth and breadth that we need to, because we won't understand the one who wrote it. We won't understand who it was written to, when it was written, why it was written, where it was written from. But beyond that, we have the theme and the problem. Every epistle is written with a theme and a problem. There's an issue, so a letter was written to address that issue. Some of them just being general issues, some of them being very, very specific, like the book of 1 Corinthians. The first multiple chapters are written about issues that somebody had come and told Paul about. Then after those first 5-7 chapters, he writes about the things the church had written to him about. But all addressing very specific issues that otherwise would have gone unaddressed. The theme and the problem. We're going to start here for a moment, and we're going to look at the theme so that we can rightly understand the problem. The theme is sola Christus. That's Latin for Christ alone. If you were here in Sunday school, Martin Luther was referenced. And he had multiple solas, one of them being sola Christus, Christ alone. The only one who is sufficient, the only one who can pay in a way that counts. And he's not sufficient, like we mentioned earlier, he's not sufficient sort of part way. He is 100% sufficient. If you're not good at math, 100% means all. Not a little left over that doesn't get covered, but all. 100%. So what was the problem he was addressing? Paul addresses the problem of self-righteous works. A people who thought that they could work hard enough to please God. So what did they do? What did the people of Colossae do to try to please God? They decided that certain days were the ritualistic good days, where you did the Christian things that would make God happy. You went to the Christian place where they all gathered. You gave the Christian money that you were supposed to give. You said the Christian things that people expected you to say on that day. Does that remind you of any place? That reminds me of the prototypical perspective of church. I am not accusing you of having that perspective. I'm really not. Now, the Holy Spirit may accuse you of having that perspective or convict you of it, but I am not. But what went on here was these people, these Christians, kind of treated Sunday like the day that mattered, and the rest of the days as the days that they got to do what they wanted. They got to gossip. They got to be vindictive. They got to be aggressive. They got to be mean. They got to be immoral. They got to be whatever or whatever or whatever. When they weren't on that day, because that's the only day that God counted score. So if they kept the right score tally on that day, God was happy. Now beyond that, they decided, oh, the other thing, we're going to have some asceticism. We're going to be ascetics. Basically, it means to deprive yourself of something so as to make God happy. And if you can deprive yourself of something well enough, God will like you. Do we struggle with that at times? Yeah. I am not saying don't deprive yourself of things. Sometimes we go the other way. We deprive ourselves of nothing. And we say, everything my eye can see, my eye gets. Everything I could possibly dream up to want, I will have. Which is also equally wrong. But the idea that if I give up a certain whatever, God will love me more, be happier with me, is false. Because the only payment God accepts is the payment of Jesus. And he paid that on the cross. Because he is 100% sufficient for you and for me. Now, there are some things that are good to avoid. There really are. There are some things that are wise to avoid because they run you into problems or could run you into problems. Case in point, I am not at this point in time worried that if I have a counseling session with somebody, a lady, and we're the only two here, that something drastically immoral is going to happen. I'm not concerned about that in this moment. But it's a wise thing for me to have Susan schedule those so that she makes sure she's here. Because if she makes sure she's here, she can say, whoa, 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 nothing went on. Nothing happened. It's just wise. If you can make it happen, make it happen. Don't make foolish choices. You don't have to, right? That's sort of the idea. So deprive yourself of some things if that's going to help you avoid immorality. When you look back at the history of the Christian American church, three or four generations ago, a decision was made by many, many Christians. You know what? The best place to get alcohol is the bar. And what we see go on at the bar is, well, not honoring to Jesus. So as to put ourselves in a place where we can intentionally be the most honoring to Jesus that we could be, we're not going to go to the bar, therefore we're not going to drink. Because it just makes sense for us as individuals to say, you know what, I don't need that. I'd rather put my effort toward focusing on following him better. Which in time turned into, Christians don't drink. So you have to deprive yourself of that, or you're a bad Christian. Right? That's what's happened in the culture of America. We've developed that mindset that Christians don't whatever because that's bad Christian stuff. That does not mean drinking's good. It does not mean drinking's bad. That's not the point. The point is depriving yourself because that's what good Christians do and God will be pleased with you no longer makes God pleased with you. But if, on the other hand, you were to choose to abstain from something, whatever that something is, because you know that that thing has a tendency to pull you away from Christ, then let it go. Whatever that is, you don't need it if it pulls you away from him. So you can let it go. But you aren't required to. And you're not allowed to require somebody else to unless they're your child living in your home. Beyond that, you don't get the required of other people, right? Unless such time comes that that thing is obviously hurting your faith. Case in point, totally hypothetical. So if this accidentally rings true to somebody's life, just choose that I don't know what's going on. Or I would have chosen a different scenario. You're a businessman. You want to make money. That's what business is for, right? That is not wrong. It is not wrong for a business to make money. You're a businessman. You're making money. Now, if the elders were to see in your life the only thing you cared about seemingly was money, and you were a member of this church, that would be addressed by one of the elders to ask some questions, to find out if what was seen was accurate or we were missing something. But if what is then seen is that your life does only care about money, then it starts a process called church discipline. Discipline not being the sort of beat you over the head until you comply sort of discipline, but trying to help you see that you're living in a way that's not honoring to Christ. That's not, as Paul's going to write in this letter, just halfway through the first chapter, not worthy of how we're called. He says to walk in a manner worthy of your calling. And if you're not doing that, then as friends, we should help change that, or at least try to bring it to your attention. It's not a mean, vindictive sort of thing. It's a, man, I care about you too much to let this go on. If I see my children being mean to each other or other people, I address it with them, not because I hate them, but because I love them. I don't address it in spite of my love for them. I address it because of my love for them. And those are the two different ways to look at it. Issues get addressed because of your care for people or in spite of it. And it should only be addressed because of your care for someone. Those are the issues that Paul saw or were told about for the Colossian church. Do you know what his solution is? His solution is Christ alone. Put your focus on him alone. He's the only one who gives righteousness. He's the only one that gives growth. He's the only one that can pay what you owe, who has the mode of payment that God will accept. Put your focus on him and on him alone. And that's the solution to all of the self-righteous work mentality that you will ever have. That's going to be the charge that he lays on us as well. That we take our attention, which is frequently for most of us divided amongst all the things that are on our table, and shift our focus only to this one. Or maybe a way to look at it different would be, it's not that you're going to push everything else off your table because you still have a job, you still have other responsibilities, but to put this one on a raised platter so you see it first. Have you ever done a remodel in your home on any level where what you've done you've really liked? There's one particular thing that you really like. When you walk up your stairs or in your door, sometimes when you do that, it's the first thing you see. We've done that in our house. You do something, you really like it. Every time I walk up the stairs, it's the first thing I see. It's the only thing I see until I look at other things. That's the perspective that we should have on Christ. He's the first thing we see. And until we intentionally say, okay, we're going to look here now, he's the only thing we see. And even when you look at this other part of your house, you still see the part that you really, really like. Well, that's how it should be for us as well. Even when we're looking at our work, what we see is Christ in light of our work. Or our work in light of Christ, however you want to look at it. When we look at our hobbies, it's the same thing. It's not just our hobbies, it's our hobbies in Jesus. At one point, I got a chance to get personalized golf balls. Okay, it didn't cost me any extra, so I said, we'll do that. And I realized that commas were important, but it said for the king on them, or phrasing was important. It said for the king. And all of a sudden, it looked like, wait, I think I'm calling me the king. But that wasn't what it was for. My intent was to remind myself, failing as though I sometimes do, that even while I was playing golf, it was for Jesus. That's what it was for. And if I didn't see my golf in light of him, if I didn't see my work in light of him, my hobbies in light of him, my family in light of him, then my focus is wrong. And I'm not seeing sola Christus. I'm seeing parto Christus. I don't know what the word is. I made it up. I'm seeing part Christ, part me, instead of sola Christus, him alone. And that's what we are to see. Christ only for our righteousness. Christ only for our focus. Christ only for everything. And then through that, he gives us the assurance that we have of following him for forever, of being with him for forever, loving him, serving him, being like him, living forever. Because it's him and him only. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for the opportunity to study a letter written with the intent of exemplifying and focusing on your Son and your Son only. I pray, Father, that we would be honoring to you as we read this, honoring to you as we learn this, honoring to you as we grow and as we mature and as you challenge us and change us. God, whatever it is that you want of us, so as to have your Son be the only focus, show us that and give us the strength that it takes to follow. We love you so very, very much, Lord. Amen.